The whole audience got sucked up again.
Okay, everybody, we're going to get started. Lecture number 8, Old Testament Survey. The Book of Ruth is a real short book. Samuel the prophet may have authored this book. I believe your textbooks say that he did not. Because Samuel the prophet died before David became the king, before he assumed the throne. However, Samuel the prophet anointed David to be the next king. He knew God had told him David was going to be the next king, so he might have went to Jesse, the father of David, and said, "Hey, give me some background on this guy. What line of family is he in?" And Jesse could have given him the story of Ruth. So Samuel the prophet, I think, authored this book. He wrote it and died before David became king, but he anointed David to be the king. Yeah?
Because it's anonymous.
What? All I mean by anonymous, all anonymous means that no one has to say the author. But we know the authors had to hold the prophetic office. Samuel was the only man. Now, they'll argue in their book that it wasn't Samuel because of this or that. Samuel anointed David to be the next king of Israel. He was concerned about David's past and David's line, and rightfully so. And so he wanted to give a little background on this little shepherd boy who was soon to become the king of Israel, even though he didn't become the king until after Samuel died. So I think Samuel the prophet probably authored this book. And this book occurred while the judges ruled. Look at verse 1 of the book of Ruth. "Now it came about in the days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land, and a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons." So it occurred during the times when the judges were ruling. And this guy said, "Hey, there's more food out in Moab." So he went and settled in Moab. Okay? But it occurred while the judges ruled. And when the judges ruled, of course, this was a time of moral decay, idolatry, and violence. But this book shows that some, even in the midst of this time, some still remained faithful to Yahweh, the God of Israel, the God who had made the covenant with his people, the nation of Israel. An outline of this book, the small book of Ruth, chapter 1, Ruth chooses the God of Israel. She didn't want to worship the false gods of the Moabites. Chapter 2, Ruth meets Boaz, who she later marries. Chapter 3, Boaz pledges to marry Ruth. And 4, Boaz redeems and marries Ruth. We'll talk about what we mean there by redeeming Ruth. That's your outline of the book of Ruth. Okay, look at verses 15 to 17 of chapter 1. "Now Naomi is Ruth's mother-in-law, and Naomi's husband and two sons died." Even their names, one of their names meant sickly or something. It was like, man, these guys were really hurting for food. "And the two of the sons and the husband died, and Naomi tells her two daughters-in-law to return to their people, return to the Moabites. You fulfilled your obligation here. You can go home to your people." Look at verses 15 to 17 of Ruth, chapter 1. And that reads, "Then she said, Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. But Ruth said, Do not urge me to leave you or turn back from following you. For where you go, I will go. And where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people. So the people of Israel will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me and worse, if anything but death parts you and me." And so what she basically said was, "I am loyal to you, I am loyal to your people, the Israelite people, and I am loyal to your God, the God of Israel. And so despite the fact that in the promised land, the 12 tribes of Israel, there's so much idolatry and immorality going on, Ruth, a Moabite woman, who became a proselyte to the Jewish faith, the Israelite faith, accepted the God of Israel, she remained faithful and would not turn back, even though she would have had just about every possible excuse, every human excuse possible to do so. Chapter 2, Ruth meets Boaz. Look at verses 1 and 2. Now Naomi had a kinsman of her husband, a man of great wealth of the family of Elimelech, whose name was Boaz. And Ruth, the Moabitess, said to Naomi, "Please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of grain after one in whose sight I may find favor." And she said to her, "Go, my daughter." Now the thing is, back then, a kinsman redeemer was one who married a childless widow of a close relative to raise up children to carry on the name of the deceased. Let me repeat that. A kinsman redeemer is one who marries a childless widow of a close relative to raise up children to carry on the name of the deceased. Common practice in Old Testament times. So Ruth, and here in chapter 2, she meets Boaz and begins to work in Boaz's field, hoping that he'll marry her and continue the family name and give her children. Chapter 3, Boaz pledges to marry Ruth, verses 7 to 13. 7 to 13 of Ruth chapter 3. When Boaz had eaten and drunk and his heart was merry, he went to lie down at the end of the heap of grain, and she came secretly and uncovered his feet and lay down. And it happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled and bent forward, and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. And he said, "Who are you?" And she answered, "I am Ruth your maid. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative." Then he said, "May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter. You have shown your last kindness to be better than the first by not going after younger men." Because young men, he was a very old guy. He was an old guy and she was a young woman, whether poor or rich. "And now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask, for all my people in the city know that you are a woman of excellence." Verse 12. "And now it is true I am a close relative. However, there is a relative closer than I. So he has no right to redeem her, to buy her back or whatever, but to redeem her from the husband, from her husband who had died, and to raise her children, unless the closer relative says, 'No, I don't want to marry her.' Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will redeem you, good, let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning." It was kind of a way to make a pledge, "I want to marry you." It was not anything sexual. No sexual immorality occurred whatsoever there. So he wanted to be her kinsman redeemer. And then in chapter 4, he marries Ruth and redeems her. Look at verses 5 and 6 of chapter 4. "Then Boaz said, 'On the day you buy the field from the hand of Naomi,'" this is what Boaz says to this other guy, "'you must also acquire Ruth, the Moabitess, the widow of the deceased, in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance.' And the closest relative said, 'I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I jeopardize my own inheritance. Redeem it for yourself. You may have my right of redemption, for I cannot redeem it.'" So apparently, if he redeemed it, bought that land and stuff like that, he might blow his own inheritance with his own family, some kind of technicality. And so it paved the way for Boaz to marry Ruth. And so he marries this young lady, even though he's an older guy. Then Boaz said, verse 9, "Then Boaz said to the elders and all the people, 'You are witnesses today that I have bought from the hand of Naomi all that belonged to Elimelech and all that belonged to Chilion and Mahlon.'" That's the two sons that died. "Moreover, I have acquired Ruth the Moabitess," or Moabitess, however you pronounce it, I don't know, "the widow of Mahlon, to be my wife in order to raise up the name of the deceased on his inheritance, so that the name of the deceased may not be cut off from his brothers or from the court of his place. You are witnesses today." The two married, verse 13, "So Boaz took Ruth, and she became his wife, and he went into her, and the Lord enabled her to conceive, and she gave birth to a son." Verses 16 and 17, the Messiah's line. Then Naomi took the child and laid him in her lap and became his nurse. And the neighbor woman gave him a name, saying, a son has been born to Naomi, so they named him Obed. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Okay? So, look at this line. And by the way, it's mentioned later on, but even Rahab the harlot is in this direct line leading to the Messiah. But what you have here is Ruth, this Moabite woman, marries Obed. He has a son named Jesse, and then Jesse has a son who is the grandson of Obed and Ruth, and that is King David. Now I think that Samuel the prophet would have wanted to get this information because he anointed David to be the next king of Israel, and God said to Saul that he was not going to be in the godly line, that the line of the Messiah was going to come from a man after God's own heart, and David was that line. So I think Samuel the prophet would have had every reason to record this, even though David hadn't had the throne already. And so I think there's a very strong argument for Samuel the prophet. Now, 1 and 2 Samuel, we're going to look at these books. And the author of 1 Samuel, I think Samuel had a part in them, and that's why it ended up getting his name, 1 and 2 Samuel. But Samuel himself dies in 1 Samuel. So obviously he did not have any part in writing 2 Samuel. But since they were a continuation, 2 Samuel was a continuation of 1 Samuel, I think he just carried on his name. So I think Samuel started writing this till his death. Then probably Nathan the prophet, who was a prophet during David's time, and Gad the prophet. Now 1 Chronicles 29:29, look at this. 1 Chronicles 29:29 mentions something real interesting here. 1 Chronicles 29:29. Now the acts of King David, from first to last, are written in the chronicles of Samuel the seer. Well, all Samuel could have wrote about David was that he anointed David to be the king, and that he killed Goliath, but then not too long after that, Samuel himself died. Are written in the chronicles of Samuel the seer, and the chronicles of Nathan the prophet, and in the chronicles of Gad the seer. And so that could be 1 and 2 Samuel or the information that went into there, but I think Samuel, Nathan, and Gad at different times added to the writings of the guy before them and are possibly the authors of 1 Samuel. It was written between 1105 and 1011 B.C. Takes you right up until the point when David reigns. David begins to reign. It covers a transition from the judges stage to the United Kingdom stage. Remember the judges stage, you got 12 separate tribes, they're not united, they're not acting in unison. And from that stage, you get a stage, Samuel is the last of the judges, then you enter into a stage where you have the United Kingdom. Outline of 1 Samuel. Samuel was a prophet, and he was the last judge of Israel before the king started. Little outline here of 1 Samuel. You have Samuel as the last judge in chapters 1 to 7. Then you have King Saul, the first king of Israel, in chapters 8 to 15. And then while Saul is still ruling, David is anointed to be the king. He isn't the king yet, not in this book. But in chapters 16 to 31, David is the focus because he's a fugitive and Saul is trying to kill him. And that pretty much would cover 1 Samuel. So Samuel, the prophet of Israel and the last judge, chapters 1 to 7. His mother Hannah is barren in chapter 1, and she prays for her son, and that prayer is answered, and Samuel is born. So then what she does, she devotes his life to the Lord, and he grows up living in the tabernacle in Shiloh and assisting the priests. Now Eli is the high priest and he has two evil sons in chapter 2. Look at verses 12 to 14 of 1 Samuel chapter 2. Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. Well, there's a big compliment. Now the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know the Lord. And the custom of the priest was priest with the people. When any man was offering a sacrifice, the priest's servant would come while the meat was boiling with a three-pronged fork in his hand. Then he would thrust it into the pan or kettle or cauldron or pot. All that the fork brought up, the priest would take for himself. Thus they did in Shiloh to all the Israelites who came. It's been offering their sacrifices. They're trying to figure, hey, if I dip this thing in here and pull out and a piece of meat comes out, it's mine. And so these guys were mooching off the people by eating the meat that they were bringing in to sacrifice. Chapter 3, God calls Samuel. It's almost a comical event. Verses 1 to 5, well, what occurs? Samuel sleeping his ministry before the Lord in the temple and the tabernacle in Shiloh, and Eli the high priest is there, and the Lord keeps calling Samuel. And he said, here I am. But he thought Eli was calling him. And they couldn't figure it out. Now, the thing was, look what it says in verse 1 of 1 Samuel chapter 3. Now the boy Samuel was ministering to the Lord before Eli. And word from the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were infrequent. Okay? You don't always have an Acts-type situation. That's one of the problems, I think, with the hyper-Pentecostalism today, is they think every day has got to be like the book of Acts. And not necessarily so. You're going to have some of those dry periods. It doesn't mean that you rule out anything supposedly supernatural, but it means you're going to have dry periods. This was a dry period. So when God started calling Samuel, last thing on earth he would think was that God was audibly calling him. Okay? Take a look at verse 8. So the Lord called Samuel again for the third time, and he arose and went to Eli and said, here I am, for you called me. Then Eli discerned that the Lord was calling the boy. See, Eli was getting ticked off. Eli was saying, look, you keep coming here telling me I'm calling you. I am not calling you, kid. I am not calling you. But then all of a sudden dawns on him, God is calling this kid, and he thinks it's me that's calling him. Look at verses 20 and 21. And all Israel from Dan, taken from verse 19. Thus Samuel grew and the Lord was with him and let none of his words fail. As a true prophet, every prophecy he ever made came true. And all Israel from Dan, even to Beersheba, knew that Samuel was confirmed as a prophet of the Lord. And the Lord appeared again at Shiloh because the Lord revealed himself to Samuel at Shiloh by the word of the Lord. And so Samuel is commissioned into the ministry in chapter 2, and chapter 3 of 1 Samuel. The Philistines capture the Ark of the Covenant in chapter 4. And Eli's sons also die. They're killed there in verses 17 and 18 of chapter 4. Hophni and Phinehas are killed by the Philistines, and the Ark of the Covenant was taken by the Philistines. But then the Ark brings tumors upon the Philistines in chapter 5. They move the Ark from city to city, no matter where they move it. These guys are dropping dead like flies. And so then they decide, hey, this is messed up, and they return the Ark to the Israelites by dropping it off. I believe at a neutral city, I'm not sure. Don't quote me on it, but that's in chapter 6, verses 19 to 21. And then Israel defeats the Philistines at Mizpah. Then in chapters 8 to 15, you have Saul, the first king of Israel. Israel asks for a king in chapter 8. Look at verses 4 to 9 of chapter 8 of 1 Samuel. It says verses 4 to 9. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations. They wanted to be just like the world. They wanted to have a king. But the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel, and they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord. And the Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. You see, Israel was a theocracy. God was ruling over them. And they rejected God. Like all the deeds which they had done since the day that I brought them up from Egypt, even to this day, and that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. Now then, listen to their voice, however. You shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them. And he gets to tell them he's going to tax your people. He's going to draft your son, put him in the military. He's going to do all kinds of things that a judge would never do. If they just trusted the Lord would have been their king and would have taken care of them. So Israel asked for a king. Samuel meets Saul, who's going to be anointed as the first king of Israel in verses 1 and 2 of chapter 9. Now there was a man of Benjamin whose name was Kish, the son of Abiel, the son of Zeror, the son of Bechorath, the son of Aphiah, the son of a Benjamite, a mighty man of valor. And he had a son whose name was Saul, a choice and handsome man. And there was not a more handsome person than he among the sons of Israel. From his shoulders and up, he was taller than any of the people. So there's a guy, Saul, a tremendous warrior, a Benjamite. Now, I believe in Judges. At the end of Judges, isn't it the Benjamites that won those two battles with all the other tribes? So the Benjamites were pretty famous for warfare. They were some pretty rough warriors. And here was the cream of the crop, a great warrior, and he was the tallest one in Israel. He might have been a seven-footer. You know how they always say that, well, they were shorter back then? The newer evidence that they're coming up with seems to indicate that, men of old were still between 5'6 and 5'9, the average height for the most part, except in certain areas where men happen to be taller. Saul could have very easily have been a seven-footer. Saul could have easily been standing head and shoulders above all of them, and he was the tallest in Israel. He was the giant among the Israelites. He should have fought Goliath later on. Goliath, of course, much bigger, about 9'9", was the giant among the Philistines. But Saul was the mightiest warrior of the Israelites and stood head and shoulders above all the other Israelites. Chapter 10, Samuel anoints Saul as the king. Chapter 11, Saul defeats the Ammonites. Chapter 12, Samuel gives his retiring message. He's no longer Israel's judge. Saul is the king now. But then in chapter 13, Saul's line is rejected by God. God says the next king is not going to be from Saul's line. The Messiah is not going to come from Saul's line. Saul was getting ready to fight the Philistines, and he was waiting for Samuel the prophet. And Samuel the prophet was supposed to come and offer a sacrifice and pray to God for him. And he figured, Samuel the prophet said he'd be here in 7 days, and he didn't get here yet. So Saul took it upon himself and intruded into the priestly office and offered the sacrifice himself. And God was ticked off. God wanted Saul to stay the king, but the prophet and the priest of Israel was Samuel, and God did not want him to intrude in his office. So by the time Samuel got there, he came there and pronounced to prophesy a word from the Lord that the messianic line will not come from Saul. Saul's line will be rejected by God. Instead, God has a man after his own heart that he's going to rise as the king and put him on the throne of Israel. And the Messiah will come from his line. Jonathan attacks the Philistines in chapter 14. Jonathan is the son of Saul, dynamite guy. He would have made an outstanding king. Him and David were two guys out of the same mold. They were extremely close friends as well. And Jonathan decides that since God is going to give us the victory, just me and my armor bearer could probably go in there and slaughter a bunch of Philistines. So he attacks the Philistines while the rest of the Jews are asleep, the Israelites are asleep. And Saul makes a foolish vow that, not knowing what Jonathan did, and he said, we're going to stay here and we're going to beat the Philistines. And until we defeat every one of the Philistines, no one gets a bite to eat. If a man gets a bite to eat, I'm going to put him to death. That's what King Saul said. Well, Jonathan wasn't there. He was already starting the battle. And he did it in the middle of the night, and it scared the Philistines so much that they were just waking up in the middle of the night and slashing each other. Everybody thought that, oh, the guy behind you might be a Philistine, then again he might be an Israelite, and boom, off with his head. And they were killing each other. So then when Saul and the rest of the Israelites get there, these guys are already killing each other, so then they just come on and complete the process and batter them. Meantime, Jonathan's done his fighting. He's really hungry, and he starts eating some food. And then the word gets back to Saul, and Saul says, oh man, I feel really bad. Now I got to put my son to death. So he's getting ready to put his son to death to keep the vow. And he's the king. And the rest of the Israelites say, you jackass, what are you doing? This guy almost single-handedly won the battle for us, and now you're going to put him to death because of some stupid vow you made? And they basically told the king, don't do this, Saul. You're going to get us highly ticked off at you if you do. So he goes against it. But that's the kind of poor leadership that Saul had. But Jonathan was a dynamite God. Saul's disobedience to God in chapter 15, look at verses 2 and 3. 1 Samuel 15, verses 2 and 3. Thus says the Lord of hosts, I will punish Amalek for what he did to Israel, how he set himself against him on the way he was coming up out of Egypt. The Amalekites would not let the Israelites pass through when they came out of Egypt under Moses. And God says, I want them wiped off the face of the earth. God's saying is, my name and my honor is more important than even the lives of women and children. I want it all wiped out so that it'll be known. If you mess with the God of Israel and with the chosen people of God, you lose. Now go and strike Amalek and utterly destroy all that he has and do not spare him, but put to death both man and woman, child and infant, ox and sheep, cattle and donkey. By the way, we do not have the right to kill innocent people. But God, who is the giver of life, he has the right to determine who lives and who dies. Okay? That's the difference between us and God. That's the situation. Just like God's law that we should not worship ourselves. It's wrong for us to be worshipped because of who we are. But it's right for God to be worshipped because of who he is. Take a look at verses 7 to 9. That was the command. Now verses 7 to 9. So Saul defeated the Amalekites from Havilah as you go to Shur, which is east of Egypt, and he captured Agag, the king of the Amalekites, alive, and utterly destroyed all the people with the edge of the sword. But Saul and the people spared Agag and the best of the sheep, the oxen, the fatlings, the lambs, and all that was good, and were not willing to destroy them utterly, but everything despised and worthless, that he utterly destroyed. So he didn't obey God. God said, wipe out. He didn't kill the king. Why? Because he probably thought, hey, if I kill this king, and then we lose in battle, they're going to kill me. They would make me an example, probably kill me slow in front of all the people and let my corpse rot in front of everybody in the middle of their biggest city. So forget that. I'll treat him nice. This way, if we ever lose, you know, not having confidence in God, if we ever lose, it'll be nice to me. Verses 10 and 11, then the word of the Lord came to Samuel, saying, I regret that I have made Saul king, for he has turned back from following me, and he has not carried out my commands. And Samuel was distressed and cried out to the Lord all night. Look at 22 and 23. Samuel said, has the Lord as much delight in burnt? He said, well, the reason why I did this, Saul, the reason why I did this was so we had animals to sacrifice to God. And that's not going to wash with Samuel. Samuel said, has the Lord as much delight in burnt offerings and sacrifices as in obeying the voice of the Lord? Behold, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. So what he basically said was, the fact that you got to sacrifice means you sinned. It's better to obey in the first place so you don't have to sacrifice in the second place. Verse 23, for rebellion is as the sin of divination, and insubordination is as an iniquity and idolatry. Because you have rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. In verses 32 and 33, then Samuel went to Ramah, but Saul went up to his house at Gibeah of Saul. And Samuel did not see Saul again until the day of his death. And for Samuel grieved over Saul. Of all that potential, this big, giant, mighty warrior, and the guy turned out to be just a big flop because of his lack of faith. And the Lord regretted that he had made Saul king over Israel. This is anthropomorphic language. He gives God human characters. God doesn't regret anything that he does because he knows what the outcome is going to be before he does it. But it just shows that Samuel displeased the Lord, and they do that by giving God a human characteristic and making it sound like God actually regretted what he had done when he made Saul the king over Israel. The rest of 1 Samuel chapter 16 to 31, David is anointed king of Israel, but he becomes a fugitive. David is anointed king in chapter 16. Look at verses 6 and 7. Then it came about, he goes to Jesse's house. Then it came about when they entered that he looked at Eliab and thought, surely the Lord's anointed is before him. And he looks at Eliab, and if Saul was 7 foot, Eliab might have been 6'8", muscle-bound dude. And he says, this has got to be the next king of Israel. Verse 7, but the Lord said to Samuel, do not look at his appearance or at the height of his stature, because I have rejected him. For God sees not as man sees, for man looks at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. I'm not looking for another big muscle-bound Saul. Eliab ain't going to be my man. My man, the next king of Israel, is going to be a giant killer. And he happens to be a little shepherd. But he's going to be a giant killer. Eliab was there in the next chapter, but he didn't fight Goliath. Saul was there in the next chapter, but he didn't fight Goliath. But a little shepherd boy named David, he did, and that was the one. Eliab's little brother, one of the other sons of Jesse, he was the one who God wanted Samuel to anoint as the king of Israel. Verses 11 and 13, and Samuel said to Jesse, are these all the children? And he said, there remains yet the youngest, and behold, he is tending the sheep. Then Samuel said to Jesse, send and bring him, for he will not sit down until he comes here. So he sent and brought him in. Now he was ruddy and with beautiful eyes and a handsome appearance, and the Lord said, arise, anoint him, for this is he. Then Samuel took the horn of oil and anointed him in the midst of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon David from that day forward, and Samuel arose and went to Ramah. And so David is anointed as the king of Israel. Look at verse 23. So it came about whenever the evil spirit came to Saul, David would take the harp and play it with his hand, and Saul would be refreshed and be well, and the evil spirit would depart from him. Saul, it turns out, was being messed with by evil spirits and needed a harpist to soothe his depression. And so David is a talented harpist, and he goes and starts playing some of the psalms that he wrote. Now, what are the Psalms? They're praise songs to God. What a better way to beat the demons away from messing with Saul, okay? And so now David is doing this, and Saul doesn't mind. Saul probably doesn't even know that David's been anointed to be the next king of Israel at that point. In fact, even later, he doesn't even remember David's name, who he is. All he knows is he's just a little punk that comes in and plays the harp for him. But he finds out more about him in the next chapter. Chapter 17 of 1 Samuel, David kills Goliath. Look at verse 4. What you got is you got two mountains, and on one mountain, you got the Israelites. On the other mountain, you got the Philistines. You're getting ready for war, and in the valley in between, Goliath, a 9'9" Philistine, mighty warrior, goes out. He was undefeated. We know that because he was still alive. And he walked out there and he said, hey, look, guys, I got an idea. Send your mightiest warrior out here. And he probably had Saul in mind, the tallest of the Israelites. Send him out here, I'll fight him. If he wins, you guys win the war. If I win, the Philistines win the war. So take a look at verse 4. Then a champion came out from the armies of the Philistines named Goliath from Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. Cubit is 18 inches and a span is 9 inches. And put it all together and you get 9'9". And by the way, he was not one of these giants that there are some giants today that have some kind of imbalance. And because of it, their glands and stuff, they become giants, but they're very weak and very frail. When you look at the size of the armor that this guy carried around with him, this was no wimp. This was a giant who was as strong as he looked. I would have loved to have seen Samson still alive to watch Samson whoop the tar out of him. Verses 8 and 9. And he stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel's and said to them, "Why do you come out to draw up in battle array? Am I not the Philistine and you servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will become your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall become our servants and serve us." So he calls out to them to do battle. Now what occurs here is David walks on the scene, the little shepherd boy, and he's going to bring some food, I guess, to the warriors. And he sees his big muscle-bound brother Eliab, and he says, "What's going on out there?" And he's watching this giant blaspheming the God of Israel. And he says, "These two guys are going to stand around and listen to that. What's going on out there?" And Eliab blows up on David. "So what business do you have, a little shepherd boy, coming out here with us warriors?" And David's probably scratching his head thinking, "Warriors? Nobody's going out there to fight them." But David ends up turning to Eliab and saying, "Hey, wait a minute. I just asked a question. Don't jump all over my case. I just asked a question." Eliab is being convicted. Big bruiser like him. I think the first guy that God wanted to fight Goliath was the tallest, the giant of Israel, Saul. But because he had a lack of faith, and by the way, Saul was willing to give away his daughter in marriage to whoever would defeat the giant. When David said, "I'll do it," he said, "Here, take my armor. I'm not going to use it." But David tried it on. It was too big. It didn't fit. He said, "No, I'll go without your armor. I'm going in the power of the Lord." But Saul, he was the biggest one in Israel. He was the mighty warrior. He was the king. God, I think, was calling him to fight Goliath. But he didn't have enough faith. So then God said, "Well, Eliab's this big muscle-bound moose. I'll have him fight Goliath." But Eliab didn't want to do it. He was all convicted. When David asked him what was going on, he blew up on David. But God said, "Hey, look, guys. Look, Saul. Look, Eliab. Let me tell you something. If my big muscle-bound thugs, if they ain't going to go and kill me a blasphemous giant today, then I'll go get me a little shepherd boy. I'll have him grab a few stones and go down from that mountaintop and go into the valley. And the God of Israel is going to kill himself a giant today. And the God of Israel is going to be glorified today. And a little shepherd boy is going to walk through the streets, the cities of Israel, holding in his hand the head of the ex-greatest, great champion from the Philistines, the head of a dead giant, whose head was removed from his body by his own sword, by a little shepherd boy." Again, it goes right back. Our problems are bigger than us, but God is bigger than our problems. And you might be big and strong like Saul, but just not have faith. And big and strong like Eliab, but not have faith. But it's not how big you are or how big your problems are. The only question comes up is, how big is your God? And if your God is the God of Israel, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob, then don't be intimidated by Goliath, because the boy is going down in the valley. His head is going to be paraded to the streets of Israel, and the God of Israel is going to be glorified. And so David kills Goliath. And chapter 17, look at verses 48 to 51. Then it happened when the Philistine rose and came and drew near to meet David, that David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. Goliath went freaked out. Said, "What the heck is this kid running at me for?" And David put his hand into his bag and took from it a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. And the stone sank into his forehead so that he fell on his face to the ground. Thus David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and a stone, and he struck the Philistine and killed him, but there was no sword in David's hand. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. And what would you do if you saw a little tiny shepherd boy of Israel whooping the tar out of your mighty warrior your giant stood 9'9". David befriends Jonathan, the son of Saul, in chapter 18, but Saul becomes very jealous. In this chapter, he becomes very jealous of King David. This is 1 Samuel 18. Word was beginning to get around about David, and they were saying Saul has killed his thousands, but David has killed his 10,000s. And Saul had just about had enough, and he was getting jealous of David. David has to flee from Saul in chapter 19. Jonathan has to tell David in verse 2 of chapter 19 that Saul, my father, is seeking to put you to death. Now therefore, please be on guard in the morning and stay in a secret place and hide yourself. Saul ends up throwing a spear at David and trying to pin him to the wall. What that meant was he was trying to get the spear right through David's body and pin him to the wall, trying to kill him. Saul's daughter ends up letting David down through a window, and he escapes from Saul. But David has to flee from Saul in chapter 19. A little bit about David's mighty men. He had some of the roughest commandos ever listed in the history of mankind, or they're listed in chapter 22 or spoken about. He gathered up a band of men. Saul went looking for the fugitive David, couldn't find him, found the priest that hit him, and so Saul ends up slaughtering the priest. He ordered his men to do it, they wouldn't do it, and then he finds one guy who's a political opportunist. The guy says, sure, I'll slaughter him, so he slaughters the priest. David then spares Saul in chapter 24, verses 3 and 4. He has an opportunity to kill Saul. It says, and he came to the sheepfolds on the way where there was a cave, and Saul went in to relieve himself. So Saul goes into the cave to go to the bathroom, and while he's relieving himself, says, now David and his men were sitting in the inner recesses of the cave. And the men of David said to him, behold, this is the day of which the Lord said to you, behold, I'm about to give your enemy into your hand, and you shall do to him as it seems good to you. Then David arose and cut off the edge of Saul's robe secretly. You know, he put his robe aside and go into the bathroom. But David decided, I'm not going to mess with God's anointing. God anointed him to be king. I'm not going to mess with him. God, I'm going to just cut off a part of his robe and show it to him later to show that I spared his life. So David spares Saul. Samuel the prophet dies in chapter 25, verse 1. Then Samuel died, and all Israel gathered together and mourned for him and buried him at his house in Ramah. And David arose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. David again spares Saul in chapter 26. Look at chapter 26. David's a great commando. Verse 5, David then arose and came to the place where Saul had camped, and David saw the place where Saul lay, and Abner, the son of Ner, the commander of his army, and Saul was lying in the circle of the camp, and the people were camped around him. David infiltrates, sneaks on through. In verses 8 and 9, then Abishai said to David, today God has delivered your enemy into your hand. Now therefore, please let me strike him with the spear to the ground with one stroke, and I will not strike him the second time. In other words, just give me one shot, I'll kill this guy for you, David. And David's mighty men were so loyal to him, especially Uriah the Hittite, and David ended up backstabbing him later on. But David said to Abishai, do not destroy him, for who could stretch out his hand against the Lord's anointed and be without guilt? So what David ends up doing in this situation here, he ends up stealing his water jug and his spear or something like that and shows it to Saul later on that, see, I could have killed you again. Chapter 27, David's men are now numbering 600. I believe there were 30 mighty men, 30 commandos, but he had 600 total at this time. He's gathering a big gathering of men who were being mistreated by Saul's government, and so they were flocking to him. Now remember, Samuel the prophet is dead, and Saul, who had outlawed sorcery, decides to go and see the witch of Endor in chapter 28. He visits the witch of Endor, and he wants her in disguise, and he wants her to bring back Samuel the prophet from the dead. So she calls on her familiar spirit, the demon that impersonates people, but he doesn't come. Instead, God sends Samuel the prophet. So the witch screams. And seeing that Samuel the prophet was sent, she realized this guy's got to be Saul. Samuel the prophet wouldn't come to show up for anybody unless it was King Saul. And so then Saul reassures her, no, I'm not out to kill you. I just wanted to get a message from Samuel the prophet. So Samuel the prophet says, oh, I got a message for you, Saul. You really blew it, man. You really messed up. You want to find out what's going to happen tomorrow in the battle against the Philistines? Well, you guys are going to get your rear ends kicked, and you're going to be dead tomorrow. And that's what you get for messing with the world of the occult. And so that's Saul's situation with the witch of Endor. And then David defeats the Amalekites with his bands of mighty men in chapter 30. And then chapter 31, Saul dies. He ends up telling his armor bearer, the Philistines are closing in. They're going to kill him slow, probably. And he says, because he's the king of Israel, he says to the armor bearer, kill me. And the guy says, hey, not on your life, but you want to kill yourself, do it yourself. So Saul falls on his own sword and kills himself. So Saul's death and Israel defeated by the Philistines. And that's in chapter 31 of 1 Samuel. That closes 1 Samuel. 2 Samuel, David becomes the king of Judah in the south. And then he, 7 years later, rules from Hebron. And then 7 years later, he takes over full control. And because Saul's son rules for 7 years the northern tribe. But then David takes them over and rules all of Israel for 33 years. So he rules for a total of 40 years, 7 years in the south, and then the other 33 years throughout all Israel. And we'll get to that in the next lecture.